hear you. Speak up now. And that's the Chabad. Well, welcome to the Supreme Court of Nevada. And over here we have some students. Wonderful. Project REAL is the relevant education about the law. I remember I was on that board for a number of years. And I'd like to welcome the all the students here. Now, what grade are you doing here?
Fifth grade.
And what grade here? Ninth grade. Okay. Well, we have a very interesting case coming up, and I'm going to call the case, which is case number 57318, Calderon Acevedo versus State of Nevada. It's a criminal case. If the attorneys would come forward, please. Because we have students here, what I'd like is each side, start with the defense, to tell the students, and if these students could move down a little bit, these students, why don't you move down closer to the end so we can have these lawyers talk to you for a second. I'd like to do this before we have argument. Now, each side is going to get to have 15 minutes of argument, but to save a few minutes and so that you'll know exactly what they're saying when they start arguing, I'm going to have the defense attorney, Mr. Geller, tell a little bit about what the case is about, and then Ms. Trippiette, is that what that is?
Trippiette.
Ms. Trippiette, if you'd say what the state of Nevada is. She's a district attorney, am I correct? And you're a public defender.
I formerly was, Your Honor, and I've since left and started my own practice, but I wanted to make oral arguments in this case.
Well, congratulations. That's wonderful. Okay, Mr. Geller, would you tell the students, just address the students, you can turn around, give us your back, it's okay,
all right,
what this case is about. We have ninth graders and fifth graders. And I certainly want to welcome on behalf of all my colleagues in the Supreme Court, the students here. We're glad that you're here and hope that you learn something from this case. Mr. Geller, go ahead.
Thank you, Judge. Well, this case involves a scenario where there were two guys and they were fighting outside of an apartment complex. And Mr. Petey's case was that my client was the person who attacked first and that he was committing the offense of battery by ultimately stabbing the other guy with a knife. And at the trial, my defense was that my client was attacked first and that he was acting in self-defense. Because one of the other individual's friends started shoving him and so forth. And so the jury listened to all the evidence, and the jury decided that my client was guilty. But one of the issues of law that came up in the case is, after the fight unfolded, my client left the scene where the fight took place and went to his own apartment, which was in the same apartment complex. But he didn't pick up the phone and call the police in the case. And Mr. Petey argued in her closing argument that if you knew that you were innocent and you hadn't done anything wrong, then naturally you would have picked up the phone and called the police and said, hey, I was a victim here, someone beat me up, I'm innocent, and please go get the bad guy. And I objected to that, and I mentioned that our Constitution suggests that you don't have to contact the police to report things and that you have a right to remain silent. And my client in this particular case said he didn't speak any English and was unfamiliar with the American judicial system. I don't believe there was any evidence that he had a phone or anything like that, and so I was saying he didn't have to make a comment to the police. And today we're going to be arguing about that point of law because it's not settled in this state, and so I'll be asking this court to find that he wouldn't have had to make a statement to the police under the circumstances because he's protected under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and then Article One of the state constitution as well.
Thank you, Mr. Gold. Mr. Petey?
My name is Hagar Trippiette. I am a district And I'm going to be arguing, contrary to what Mr. Geller told you, that the statements that I did make during my closing arguments were not comments as to the defendant's pre-arrest silence. I merely told the jury what he failed to do. What he failed to do was call 911, call the police. So I referred more so to his lack of conduct and his failure to act and didn't make mention of his pre-arrest silence. So that's
going to
be essentially my argument.
And both of you were the trial attorney for the state?
I was.
And you were the trial attorney?
I was, yes.
So these are the two attorneys that actually tried the case in the district court. And then everybody who's convicted of a crime in the state of Nevada can appeal to the Supreme Court, and there's no court in between, although someday we hope to have a court in between us, Court of Appeals. But at least for now, everybody who's convicted of a crime in the state of Nevada has a right to appeal to the Supreme Court. And then the seven of us are going to hear the case, and then after the case is over, we're going to go talk about it and decide which way we're going to go. And then within a certain amount of time, we'll write a decision, which will either be a legal opinion or a legal order. as to whether the appellant, the defendant will prevail, the person who was convicted, or the state of Nevada will prevail in this matter. I'm going to let the justice say.
I guess I want you to know that what happens if this side wins here, then potentially the case could be tried again. If this side wins, then nothing happens. It's sort of just the case goes on, the sentence imposed will be served. I think that sometimes there's a mystery about what happens once we make a decision in the real world.
And defendant was sentenced to prison?
He actually was sentenced to probation. However, because he was here unlawfully, he was taken into ICE custody and has since been deported to Mexico, is my understanding.
Immigration and custom enforcement is ICE. That's what we're talking about. So we have some unique things in this case, and I'm glad that we have the attorneys to explain to these students. Okay, now we're ready for a regular argument. Each side gets 15 minutes. Mr. Kelly, you get to go first, and you can reserve some time if you'd like.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my name is Warren Geller, and I am representing the appellant, Serafine Calderon Acevedo, in the instant case. And if I may, I'd like to request 4 minutes for rebuttal, if I can reserve that time. Although there are many issues of noteworthy appellant before the Court in this case, I'm going to focus my argument on the issue that Chief Justice Cherry indicated was of the Court's highest concern in its order of November 13th, and that's the issue of pre-arrest silence. Specifically, that order asked the attorneys to address two things. And first, whether or not the appellant's failure to remain at the scene of the fight constituted pre-arrest silence. The period of time was a few hours from when the fight took place to the point in time when he actually went back to his own apartment complex and remained there, remained there and did not contact the police. And I submit that that particular portion is the easier one to resolve, because we do have law in this jurisdiction that arguably settles that matter. There was a case of Murray versus State, and that involved a murder where the defendant was accused of murdering someone outside of the North Las Vegas casino in 1987. And he remained at large until 1988. And there were comments made by the prosecution in the closing argument of that case that because the defendant didn't speak up in that year's time, that you could infer that he was conscious of doing some wrongdoing in that particular case. And the Court ruled there that that period of time between 1987 and 1988 did constitute pre-arrest silence. So I do think that we do have a case in this jurisdiction that addresses that and would characterize the point in time between when an incident unfolds, in this case it's a fight, in that case it was a murder, and the time when the suspect reports it to the police or is apprehended by the police as pre-arrest silence. I do want to clarify for the record that in that particular case, this Court held that the prosecutor's comments were not error. However, that particular defendant took the stand and testified in his own defense. And so that case is distinguishable because there's relevant U.S. Supreme Court precedent that suggests that if a defendant takes the stand, then you can use pre-arrest silence as a source of impeachment evidence. In this particular case, that's not before us. But I'd like to then turn to the second issue from the Court's November 13th order, which is whether or not it was prosecutorial misconduct for the state to comment on the defendant's failure to call the police in that two-hour window. And we do have a circuit split in the federal circuits in the United States, and there also are various states that go either way on this. And obviously I would be encouraging this Court to adopt the rule that we see in the First, Seventh, and Tenth Circuit, wherein the prosecution may not comment on the defendant's silence. And I do want to also point out that in the state's brief, they indicate that the Ninth Circuit would go against the rule of law that I'm advocating for. But I would submit that it wouldn't. And that case is Opplinger versus United States. And I want to distinguish that right out of the gate because I believe that this Court can interpret the federal Constitution and the Fifth Amendment as affording protections for the defendant, as well as the state Constitution. Now, in Opplinger, there was a situation wherein the defendant was a purchasing manager for a bank up in Washington State. And he was purchasing things at Costco and then returning those items for cash and pocketing the cash. And Mr. Opplinger was confronted about that by his bank manager. The bank manager said, "Aren't you responsible for this? You're going to need to account for this." And Mr. Opplinger just put his hands in his face and didn't really respond. And so the assistant U.S. attorney in that case in the closing argument mentioned that the fact that he didn't respond and just put his face in his hands is indicative of his guilt. But I would submit that that is distinguishable from the instant case because that was a private citizen speaking to another private citizen. That was the employee speaking to his bank manager. So it wasn't a situation wherein the prosecutor was commenting on a suspect or a defendant's failure to contact the government. And I think that's a very important distinction. The reason is the Fifth Amendment protects us from interrogations and investigations from the government. It's never been applied in a situation where there's a private entity having a conversation with a defendant and that those statements were not admissible, unless one could make an argument the private entity was acting at the behest of the government. But that certainly wasn't the case in the Oppenger case. So our position is that the Ninth Circuit precedent still leaves plenty of room for this court to interpret protections under the federal constitution such that the prosecution would not have been able to comment on his pre-arrest silence. However, even if this court finds that Oppenger does foreclose the possibility of federal protection in this area, I do believe that the state constitution, specifically Article 1, Section 8, also, which has asserts that the defendant has the right to remain silent or the accused has the right to remain silent, that provides an area where this court can also rule that you have state protection as well. And we don't always see that this court's rulings mirror exactly what the federal constitution or Ninth Circuit of the U.S. Supreme Court's rulings are. For instance, up until the case of Arizona versus Gantt, this court provided more protection for its citizens with respect to automobile searches in a Fourth Amendment context. And so if this court determines that Oppenger forecloses the possibility of federal protection under the United States Constitution here, I would certainly urge the court to consider providing that protection under the state constitution as well. And I believe that it certainly is consistent with what I believe the Founding Fathers would have wanted under this circumstance, but also with public policy issues. The facts of this case involved a defendant who didn't speak the English language. There was no evidence that he had access to a cell phone. He was just beaten very badly. Ultimately, he was accused of stabbing the other party. However, he heard testimony at trial that he had a number of bruises and scratches all about his body. And so he just left an area where he was outnumbered, went back to his apartment complex, and he was bloodied and bruised, doesn't speak the English language, and wasn't in the United States lawfully. So we can imagine a scenario here where he probably would not have been that inclined to call the police. Now, the government made comment on that, suggesting that the only reason you wouldn't contact the police in that context is because you knew you'd done something wrong. And I certainly don't think that that is the only reason. Possible deportation, not speaking the English language, not being familiar with the American judicial system and the police practices would be one of many reasons why the appellant may very well not contact the police.
Counsel, isn't there, within this gambit, an issue as to whether it's deemed as a comment as to conduct versus a comment as to admission or a tacit admission?
I would submit that there is a distinction, Your Honor. The United States Supreme Court in Pennsylvania versus Muniz determined that in a DUI stop, that the prosecutor would be able to comment on the defendant's behavior, slurred speech, that his gait was staggering, things like that, because they're not the contents of the defendant's mind. Whereas the prosecutor in this case commented on his failure to pick up the phone and speak his mind to the government. And that's a relevant distinction because the Fifth Amendment only protects the contents of one's mind, and that's profound in Pennsylvania versus Muniz and its progeny in the United States Supreme Court, and it's been echoed by the Ninth Circuit as well. So in the situation here, the state was very much emphasizing that failure to pick up the phone and speak, and I would submit that that's a relevant distinction in that the Fifth Amendment certainly would protect him from being obligated to pick up the phone and contact the government. But moving on, I think that there are circumstances certainly where the police would take advantage of the rule of law if it were advocated or accepted as the state advocates it in such a way that the police can comment, or the prosecutor rather, can comment on someone's failure to contact the police. And specifically, it would encourage law enforcement to hold back on giving Miranda warnings and hold back to the extent practical on making an arrest to keep the person talking and so on and so forth. Now, obviously, a suspect probably wouldn't be aware of those nuances of the law. And so the appellant advocates for a rule of law that's clear and easy to follow in this jurisdiction, simply that unless you take the stand and testify, in which case you can be impeached with your failure to make a comment, your failure to make a comment or election to remain silent cannot and will not be used against you. That's a clearer rule of law than what the state advocates for, wherein The situations can become extremely nuanced, and they encourage law enforcement to hold back on arrest, potentially, and hold back on issuing Miranda warnings for the purposes of essentially trying to catch a defendant in a scenario where he's unsure of his rights, doesn't know whether or not to make a statement, and maybe would prefer to contact an attorney first. And I do want to touch on some of the language of the federal and state constitution, for that matter, as it's relevant in this case. We certainly see that in the Sixth Amendment, the language of the Sixth Amendment affords the accused is the pertinent word, the accused the right to counsel and the other primary rights, excuse me. However, the Fifth Amendment says a person has the right to remain silent. We see in the United States Supreme Court of Alabama versus Coleman, the accused means in that context, once you're in court. In that case, the Supreme Court held that you have a right to an attorney at a critical stage, and that critical stage in that particular case was the preliminary hearing. The appellant there was not afforded an attorney at that phase. But the Founding Fathers did not use the phrase accused in the Fifth Amendment. They used the phrase person. And we certainly see that in plenty of Fifth Amendment holdings, Miranda and its progeny, that you don't have to already be formally an accused, as in the context of a criminal case in court, before the Fifth Amendment protections apply. And so obviously the appellant in this case was a person in the literal meaning of the word from the time the fracas unfolded and all the way to the time when the police ultimately apprehended him a few hours later at his home. And so in that context, I believe that the Founding Fathers' original intent would have protected conduct like this and would have allowed the defendant, who I'll emphasize again, didn't even speak the English language, to remain silent under that circumstance. And finally, I wanted to point out as well that the comments made by the prosecution in this case, although it certainly have a constitutional flavor to them, obviously with the Fifth Amendment issue before the court, but it's also a form of constitutional burden shifting. Obviously, the state has the burden of proving the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And saying that in closing argument, he didn't speak up, he didn't say anything, that tends to suggest that the defendant has an affirmative obligation to explain away his conduct. And again, there's a circuit split in the states that on that issue, but I would submit following the 1st, 7th, and 10th Circuit, and also the states of Washington and Ohio, which ruled that the defendant would have the protection from being forced to make a statement or otherwise face the consequences of having the prosecutor essentially mock him or her for it in the closing argument, is the preferable rule of law. Certainly, in that context, we can imagine circumstances where the prosecutor could emphasize in great laboring detail about how long someone was at large without contacting the police, emphasizing, you know, this person, as we saw in the Murray case, they were at large for an entire year. And there's a lot of legitimate reasons for that, and the person certainly has no affirmative obligation to give a statement, but the prosecution would be able to essentially parade that in front of the jury, and that's what we submit happened in this particular case. And so it's our position that this is a form of burden shifting, not just with respect to who bears the burden of proof, but also a form of burden shifting with a constitutional flavor here. And I see that my time is about to expire, so unless any justices had any questions, I reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
I do have one.
Counsel.
Yes. assuming that the court concluded that there was a pre-arrest silence issue here and a Fifth Amendment implication, if we didn't agree with your burden shift argument, what would the analysis from your point of view be for reversal for just a pure prosecutorial misconduct analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. In McCraney versus State, this court ruled that when analyzing prosecutorial misconduct, the court has to find that it would have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And so applying that particular standard here, obviously that's a tremendously high burden for the respondent to reach in this particular case. But under the circumstances, our position, of course, would be that that comment was so damaging that certainly the respondent would not be able to reach that high burden and the case would be ripe for reversal. Thank you.
Mr. Poole?
Good morning, Chief Justice Cherry, Supreme Court Justices, and may it please the courts. I will begin by addressing the issue that was raised by appellant, primarily the pre-arrest silence issue, and specifically whether my statements during closing arguments that the defendant not only failed to call 911, but failed to remain at the scene and wait for the sirens to arrive, to explain his side of the story, whether those statements that I made during my closing argument amounted to comments on the defendant's pre-arrest silence. We submit to you that those statements were not, in fact, comments on the defendant's pre-arrest silence, and they were comments on his lack of conduct and failure to act. The Murray case that was brought up by the appellant is completely distinguished by the case here, because in that case, over a year went by before the defendant made any statements. In this case, less than 2 hours went by, and I pointed out in my closing arguments what merely was a natural occurrence that was factual in nature, that the defendant didn't call 911, that the defendant didn't remain in the scene. Now, assuming arguendo that you were to find that these statements did allude to the defendant's pre-arrest silence, it is our position that under the Jenkins case, U.S. versus Jenkins, which is 447 U.S. 331, Jenkins involved, let me tell you a little bit about Jenkins if you're unfamiliar with the facts. A defendant was, he killed an individual that robbed his sister, and he did not tell anyone or go to the police for 2 weeks after the incident. He later claimed that he killed the individual in self-defense when he came after him to retaliate for the crime involving his sister. Now, the Jenkins court held that statements regarding that two-week wait period before the defendant went and told police officers what had occurred were permissible in that trial because they were permissible to impeach his self-defense argument. And specifically, the Jenkins court stated that that a defendant can't unveil his cloak of silence for his own use, in this case his self-defense argument, but expect the state to make no mention of it and expect a right of self-incrimination. So in this case, similar to the Jenkins case, the defendant, by 2 hours later, when he was confronted with by police officers who went to his apartment and he made those self-defense arguments, he told them that he acted in self-defense, he, like the defendant in Jenkins, unveiled his cloak of silence. So it's not fair for him to stay silent and then expect, he essentially unveiled his cloak of silence and claimed self-defense, and later the pre-arrest silence becomes admissible as impeachment evidence. Now what follows is their argument that the statements made by the prosecutor constituted prosecutorial misconduct, but we submit that if the court were to find that the statements were improper, the high standard by Green versus State completely does away with any type of prosecutorial misconduct. The Green court held that every defendant in a criminal trial is guaranteed a fair trial, but not necessarily a perfect trial. And it's not enough that the defendant believes that the prosecutor's remarks were undesirable. He has to show that they were harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And in this case, any errors made were harmless because there was an overwhelming amount of evidence as to the defendant's guilt. We have, in this case, that two witnesses actually independently identified the defendant as the person that stabbed the victim. We have the defendant admitting to using a knife. We have the trail of blood that led to the defendant's apartment. The knife is found hidden in the defendant's bathroom. The defendant changes his story to police officers when he provides his self-defense argument. And any argument of self-defense was completely foreclosed by the fact that there was no weapon found on the defendant, there were no injuries found on the defendant, the use of the knife was actually beyond the force necessary for self-defense, and again that he changed his story. So we submit that any errors that this court find were made were harmless in nature in light of that overwhelming evidence. I'll move on and begin with the other issues that the appellant has on appeal. And the first issue, the first question was the race question. And it's the defense stated that certain race questions and self-defense questions were not permitted to be asked on voir dire. It's the state's response that race is always an inappropriate question. It has no bearing on counsel's ability to determine the existence of any type of juror prejudice. In regards to the self-defense questions, the district court judge declined to ask jurors these questions because they related to issues of law, which are inappropriate for voir dire. In regards to the second issue on appeal, the admission of the knife evidence, the defendant claims that the consent to search card authorized search of his former apartment, number 71, rather than the apartment that was actually searched, apartment number 115. And the state submits that the defendant gave verbal authorization by standing in front of the door of the apartment, indicating that the apartment was his, and when asked multiple times, he told police officers that they may search that apartment. With regards to the third issue on appeal, whether the trial court erred by admitting evidence that the defendant bit Hernandez, which Hernandez was one of the other, not the victim, but one of the other parties that were at the scene during the incident. The state submits that such evidence of this bite that occurred did not amount to Brady evidence because it was available to the defense through other means. They could have found out about this evidence through their own investigation by interviewing the witnesses prior to trial. And such evidence was also not exculpatory because the actual victim, as I stated, was not involved. It was a third party that was bit. It was not a prior bad act because it was submitted as a full and accurate account of the crime. And lastly, we submit that, any error, if found, was harmless in light of the evidence found. In regards to the fourth issue raised by the appellant regarding witness intimidation, the state submits that no such evidence was prevented. No evidence linking the defendant to an unnamed friend that went to the apartment, and if and courts have held in Lay versus State that any evidence regarding witness intimidation, if it does not directly reference defendant, a prejudice cannot be shown. The fifth evidence raised by appellant was that the Sixth Amendment right to confront witnesses were violated by admission of the victim's statement to police officers. The state submits that any type of statement admitted was admissible under the excited utterance evidence of the hearsay rule. And that is because the victim actually was strapped to the gurney, attempting to get off the gurney when he made the statement. It was not more than 45 minutes after the incident occurred. And by an examination of the totality of circumstances, including to whom the statements were made, they were made in this case to a police officer and conducting investigation, whether the statements were spontaneous, in this case they were made while the investigation was ongoing because the defendant was still at large. They didn't know where he was at this point. So it is classified as spontaneous statement. The purpose, in this case, it was to assist in the investigation. And for the foregoing reasons, this statement is classified as an excited utterance and becomes admissible under the hearsay exception. The sixth issue raised by appellant was that the trial court erred by allowing the police officers to opine that the defendant was dishonest. The state's response to this is that, number one, this issue was not objected to at trial. I'm going to wrap up and just merely state that The state feels that it should win this appeal. The most important issue we're arguing today is whether the pre-arrest silence, if the court finds that the comments were in relation to the defendant's pre-arrest silence, were admissible, because although the defendant in this case didn't testify at trial, he unveiled his cloak of silence by providing a self-defense argument to police officers, which was elicited at trial and which was heard by the jury at trial. So because he told police officers that he acted in self-defense, his pre-arrest silence comes in to impeach that evidence. I think
so. Isn't the holding in Jenkins narrower than that? In Jenkins, the court was commenting on the fact that the defendant had testified. Seems to me that's quite a bit different than the defense asserting a defense of self-defense.
Well, it's our position that the fact that he made a self-defense argument is exactly as though he were to testify at trial, because the same statements came out and were heard by the jury. So his argument is testimonial. Whether or not he actually took the stand at trial, he still had the opportunity to have the jury hear those self-defense arguments because they came in through a police officer.
And so in the state's view, in every case in which a defendant asserts self-defense, it can argue pre-arrest silence without violating the Fifth Amendment.
Exactly, and that's our essential argument. If you look at all the line of cases that hold opposite, those are cases where the defendant maintains his silence throughout not only the investigatory part of the case, but also throughout the trial. So there is never any type of self-defense argument made. The jury never hears any type of self-defense argument. And in most cases, the state submits that, yes, the defendant has a Fifth Amendment privilege to remain silent, and that it would be improper for any comments on that pre-arrest silence to be made. But in this case here, he asserted a self-defense argument that he didn't only tell police officers that he acted in self-defense, but the defense counsel made mention of that during the trial in their arguments, and they elicited it through the officer. The officer that actually heard the defendant's self-defense argument, his testimony came in and was heard by the jury. So it's only fair for the state to be able to impeach the defendant with such evidence and let the jury know that, hey, wait a second, he didn't call 911, and he didn't remain at the scene and flag officers down and say, hey, listen, I had to do this because they were hurting me. He left, he went to his apartment, and we have every right to comment on the conduct that occurred in light of his, to rebut any self-defense arguments that were made.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Rapini.
Thank you.
Mr. Gallo, rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have a little over 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Judge. Just a few things I'd like to point out. The state did mention in its argument that Jenkins versus Anderson, the United States Supreme Court, stands for the proposition that the prosecutor can, in fact, comment on the defendant's pre-arrest silence. That case is distinguishable from this case because in Jenkins, the defendant took the witness stand, and the Supreme Court was very, very careful to emphasize that that comment was acceptable only for the purposes of impeachment. In the case before this court, the defendant did not take the witness stand. And that's why we have a circuit split on this particular issue, is because the Supreme Court has never had occasion to address the issue of whether pre-arrest silence can be used by the prosecution in closing remarks or otherwise in a circumstance like we have here. That's why there's a circuit split. So that issue certainly is not settled, and I wanted to emphasize that.
So that essentially you're saying that your self-defense is not impeachable.
That's correct, unless the defendant takes the stand. His credibility would not be impeachable with pre-arrest silence. Certainly the state would be able to admit other evidence, such as what other witnesses saw, things of that nature. It's not that the state can't rebut.
If it was a statement, he's essentially testifying through a police officer who's giving his statement to the police officer to the jury.
Well, this is actually
unimpeachable.
No, Your Honor, this is a non-statement because the prosecutor's commenting on the fact that he didn't make a statement to the police.
Okay.
So they're commenting on a non-statement. It might open another can of worms if we had a situation where the defendant did make a statement and the law would likely allow the prosecutor to admit what he said to the officer, as they often do in closing argument. But here we're just addressing his invocation of his right to remain silent.
How exactly did the self-defense come out?
I was under the impression that through the test officers.
How did it come out?
Yes, what happened in the case, the officers, of course, showed up after the fact. But this was a fracas involving multiple individuals, and so we had several other witnesses at the scene that were called by the state, involved, including one of the alleged victim's friends, Mr. Hernandez, that the state's attorney alluded to before. So we had live witnesses from the scene that commented on what they observed. So that's how we were able to establish self-defense and put that defense forward. In fact, I did want to clarify one thing. I believe the state's attorney mentioned that there were no injuries or very few injuries on my client, on the appellant. But that was not, in fact, the case. If I just may finish the thought.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. On page 277 of the appendix, you see in the transcript that when the police investigator was testifying with photographs of the injuries, it was the appellant that had multiple injuries, scratches, bruises, cuts, all over his body. And the alleged victim only had a single knife wound in the side. And it was our argument in closing arguments and throughout the course of the trial that that was evidence of self-defense, that as a last resort, the appellant used the knife because he was being beaten so badly.
And you got self-defense instructions in before the jury?
Yes, Your Honor, we did.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gunn. Mr. Petey, thank you very much for your argument this matter, also for explaining to the students about this case. I appreciate both of your comments to the students. And this case will stand submitted.
Thank you.
And are the students going to stay for the 11:30 argument, or are they going to... Okay, well, I'll let you leave with your students. Students, thank you very much for coming. I hope you enjoyed the argument from the district attorney and from the defense attorney in this matter. It seemed like it was an interesting argument. We'll let them leave. And how about our ninth graders? Are our ninth graders going to stay for one more argument, or are you going to leave? Okay, we have another case, which we're going to take a short break because we've been on the bench since 10 o'clock. So I know that my colleagues will want to take a short break. We'll just take about a 5-10 minute break, and then we'll do the quote 11:30 case. Again, thank you, Mr. Petey, and thank Mr. Gell.
All right.
And that case will stand submitted, please.